Hello and welcome to Buffalo HealthCast, a podcast by students, faculty, and staff of the University at Buffalo's School of Public Health and Health Professions. We're your co-hosts, Tia Palermo,
Jessica Kruger,
and Skylar Lawson. And in this podcast, we cover topics related to health equity here in Buffalo, around the U.S., and globally. In this first semester of the podcast, we're taking a deeper look at racism and health.
We'll be talking to experts around the U.S., as well as individuals here on campus and in the Buffalo community who are working to remove inequities to improve population health and well-being. You'll hear from practitioners, researchers, students, and faculty from other universities who have made positive changes to improve health equity and inclusion.
All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Buffalo HealthCast. I am your host, Skylar Lawson, a first-year PhD candidate in community health and health behavior. With us today is Reverend George Nicholas, a co-convener of the African American Health Equity Task Force and a member of the Concerned Clergy Coalition of Western New York. Thank you for taking the time to be interviewed with us today.
Well, it's certainly an honor and a great opportunity to be with you today.
Great. So first off, can you, for our listeners, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, I'm from Buffalo. This is my home. I grew up here and then went to Ohio State University for undergraduate and then came back to the area. Have a graduate degree from the University of Buffalo and had been working, doing various jobs, doing things. I've owned companies. I was the CEO of the Geneva B. Scruggs Community Health Center at the time. And then I, decided to answer the call that the Lord put on my life many years ago to go into ministry full time. And I did that and was pastoring Rochester for about 12 years. And then, the Lord called me back to Buffalo, and I've been back here since about 2012.
Yeah. A lot of history in Buffalo.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. This is home. And, I've seen the, ups and the downs, and, I think we're in an opportunity to really do something transformative right now. And it's necessary because, I've seen how Black Buffalo really hasn't progressed. Some of the things that, in terms of, we have less businesses now, we have less community-based organizations. We're almost, we're so vulnerable. We used to have, the Geneva B. Scruggs Community Health Center, which was a community health center that served this community. We had the St. Augustine Center, which is a tremendous community-based organization on Fillmore Avenue. They're no longer there. The Langston Hughes Cultural Center, which was at 50 High Street, was a tremendous cultural center, the Friends of the Elderly. And we had, there were a number of programs and that were run by Black people and that addressed the needs of Black people. And over time, these things have not been supported by the existing political establishment, and they've gone away. And then certainly on the business side, we had tons of cleaners and restaurants and all kinds of things. Jefferson Avenue, Fillmore Avenue, parts of Genesee, they were bustling with Black owned and operated companies. And don't have. And so, and then finally, and I know we're going to get into these questions, but I think it's important to put things in a context. When I'm 57 and, when we were coming up in the area, the notion of, Black kids not graduating from high school wasn't even a conversation. You graduated from high school. But now, we have folks struggling just to graduate from high school. And then even as they matriculate onto the campuses at the University of Buffalo, there's probably less Black students from Buffalo there now than there was 15, 20 years ago. So we got to turn this thing around, Skylar. We're not going in the right direction. But we'll talk about that a little bit later too, if you want to.
I agree with you.
Leadership.
I agree with you, and like you said, even though the current the current situation appears to be bleak, you did say that there is an opportunity for transformation and hopefully lasting changes, which is a great segue into African American Health Equity Task Force, which appears to be a force for good with respect to the issues that you mentioned.
Yeah. So we've been working really hard since about, it started off with a conversation with just a few of us. This woman named Mary Walls at the time was working, I think, for the Heart Association or the Red Cross, one of those places. And she wanted to engage some Black clergy in a conversation about colorectal cancer and how do we, there's a disproportionate amount of Black people who suffer from that. And so I challenged the group to think bigger. And to look at, the overall health of Black Buffalo, the factors that were driving high colorectal cancers are the same factors that are driving diabetes and heart disease and asthma and all kinds of things, hypertension, and it's the social determinants of health, right? There has to be a shift between thinking about and looking at Black health and putting all the blame upon the behavior of people in the Black community, that old adage, well, y'all just eat too much fried foods and all this other stuff. Well, that's part of the equation. But when you look at what, the reputable organizations that deal with public health, the World Health Organization, the Center for Disease Control, the National Institute of Health, and every reputable organization that focuses on public health will tell you that the driving factor, the most influential factor that impacts the health of an individual are the social determinants of health, right? The lived environment, the economic status, educational attainment, interfacing with the criminal justice system, the air and water quality in the neighborhood, the quality of your housing stock. These are the things that drive health outcomes. And if you live in community where you have access to the things that you need to maintain good health, then your health outcomes will be significantly better. But if you're living in a community where you don't have access to fresh fruits and vegetables because there's no grocery stores that are within a close distance proximity to your community, it makes it difficult for you to purchase the things that you want to put in your refrigerators and on your dinner table that are healthy. And if you're living in a situation where your economic status is such that you have limited income and limited resources, then the food choices that you make for you and your family are going to be influenced by your income, not necessarily about what's always healthy, because healthier food is more expensive in a lot of cases. And then we'll say, well, why don't you just change your economic status? Well, if the job opportunities are not available for you and your community, or if the jobs are there's a lot of jobs in Grand Island and places like that, but if there's not transportation and you don't have means for that transportation, then that creates a problem for you. And so these are the things that drive the what we call the social determinants of health. And so our work, our mission with the African American Health Equity Task Force, it started off calling ourselves the African American Health Disparities Task Force, but we wanted to shift our thinking to a more aspirational. We want to talk about where do we want to be, right? And where we want to be is health equity. And so we're unapologetic earned with the health conditions of Black people. Right. So this is not a minority thing, and not to take hits or slights at it. But there are a unique set of circumstances that are attached to the enslavement of the African people, really in this hemisphere, starting in 1519, when you look at the slave trade by the Spaniards and the Dutch and other those in the French in the and South and Central America, and then escalating into around 1619, migrating up north to what is called, what they called North America, but it was a land that was inhabited by the indigenous people. And then so this whole notion of the enslavement of African people in this region has from beginning begun the process of the social determinants of health, right? Because the lived environment, economic opportunities, housing, right? And from that moment, African people living in America were at a disadvantage, right? And that continued throughout generations, right? So you have enslavement from 1619 to 1865, but even longer than that, scholar, because with the enactment of black codes and African American men forced to work in steel mills and coal mines in Alabama, Tennessee, and other parts of the South after being arrested for vagrancy, right? And then the inability to accumulate wealth through the sharecropping system, and just the debt that was begun to just weigh upon freed African people living in America. And so that just, you know, from generation to generation passed on. And then even as we began to migrate into the North, and beginning to fill some of these jobs during industrialization. But then as these jobs became unionized, and then the migration of those from Western Europe began to come in from Italy and Ireland and other places like that, and Poland, they took those jobs. They displaced folks who had migrated from the South and moved up to the North. And so then this whole economic disenfranchisement of African people living in America has created such a wealth gap that even today, in the year 2020, for every dollar of wealth a black person has in America, a white person has $18. And so, you know, the medium, I believe, and you guys are students, so you'll look up this data, but it's about African Americans who have about $18,000 of wealth versus over $100,000 by whites. And I'm talking about income, I'm talking about wealth. And why is that? Well, post Second World War, right? And the beginning of when soldiers began to be able to purchase homes as a result of the GI Bill. They were pushed into communities, segregated communities, and then red lines were drawn, and soldiers couldn't even use their GI Bill that they had earned on the battlefield, fighting for freedom for other people, and forced to live in communities that, you know, just to create an economic disparity. And then as banks over time, as banks value property, right? Because one of your biggest asset is your property, right? And then one of the factors that they put into in terms of valuation of your property is the demographics, let me say, of that community. So black folks living in black communities, buying homes, investing in homes, but then getting less equity out of their properties than white people in white communities, right? And then you have what I call ghetto taxes. If you have your car insurance is going to be higher if you live in a black community than if you live in a white community. Life insurance, higher premiums if you're black than if you're white. So all these things, Scott, they just suck the wealth out of black communities. And then finally, the interaction with the criminal justice system, right? Whereas, you know, black people are disproportionately arrested and convicted for crimes, higher bails, longer sentencing, right? And so what happens when a young black person gets in trouble with the law? Well, it's grandmama and them that have to dip into the savings, the dollars that they began to generate wealth with, or that they would want to pass down to their family members, right? Second mortgages taken on that house that they had finally paid off, to pay legal fees and things like that. And so this whole cycle, just again, sucking the wealth out of the community, which creates and feeds into these disparities, right? And so this is the level of how we want to attach these issues of health inequities or health disparities, as opposed to just doing the traditional health fairs and giving people balloons and coffee mugs and thinking that that's going to change outcomes.
In light of this, the daunting challenges that you listed, where does the African American Health Equity Task Force factor in alleviating or kind of even, solving the problems caused by this multi-generational, structural, damage that's been, wrought upon Black communities?
Well, it starts with, truth telling, right? It's you can't address problems that you don't recognize are problems, right? And so we want to change the narrative about why these conditions exist, right? And to focus more on systemic changes, right? And looking at systemic causes, so that our solutions will impact the systemic causes. I mean, let me put it this way. One of the things that, and I'm, I'm not critical of it, I'm just trying to make an analysis, is that one of the things that happens every year is the beginning of the school year, people who heard me speak, and I use this analogy all the time, is there's always this big push to get kids backpacks, right? And we're going to give kids brand new backpacks. But yet there's no data that says the reason why Black children are underperforming in urban schools is because they don't have a backpack. Right. And so the remedy has nothing to do with the problem. Right. Because if the child is still going to a failing school in an at-risk neighborhood, and if mother and father still don't have the kind of economic opportunities, if the air and water quality in their community is all these other factors, if that has not been impacted, then the fact that this child has a new backpack really will have a limited, if any, impact upon their ability to achieve academic excellence. Not talking about passing, right? See, we've shifted our thinking. And I'm so proud, brother, that you're working on your PhD, right? But the thought process that we're just, think about this, man. That we're putting a lot of energy, and it's necessary because of what the current reality is, to get kids, our children, just to pass, right? And what we really should be pushing is scholarship and academic excellence, right? Right? If you, what do you have to get a 70 or 65 to pass? Let's say 70. If you get a 70, that means that 30% of the information that was provided for you, you didn't get. 30%. That's right, right. So our work is to look at systemic issues, raise the concerns, and then bring forth community collaborations to bring community-based solutions, and then engaging partners, institutional partners, to invest their resources into the solutions. Whether it be financial resources, whether it be intellectual capacity, whether it be access to information, whatever these institutions have could be available to them, we're saying use those resources and invest this into creative problem solving as it relates to the issues in the African American community.
Yeah, thank you for your response. It definitely helps our listeners understand, the breadth of what the African American Health Equity Task Force does. I do have a particular question. What have been some of the the approaches that the task force has taken with regard to the COVID-19
pandemic.
Yeah,
well, there we have a good news story there, Skylar. Let me, and it shows, it's actually proof positive to our hypothesis of the importance of community collaboratives and in supporting Black leadership. And let me frame this for you. So since we had been doing, so we put out our report in 2015 about the conditions of the African-American community, the health conditions, which showed that, and you can, people can have access to these reports on buffalohealthequity.org, buffalohealthequity.org. And in our initial report, just using state and county data, and concentrating on five or six zip codes where the predominant number of African Americans live on the east side of Buffalo, we found that that in terms of and just looking at chronic disease, that an African American who lives in one of those communities has a 300% more likelihood to have a chronic disease than a white person that lives outside the community. So we're talking about.
That's very stark.
And it translates to about 10 to 12 lost years of life. Right. And so we were equipped with the data. And so when COVID-19 emerged, we knew that because of the high rates of diabetes, asthma, and heart disease, which are three comorbidities that make an individual more susceptible to COVID-19, that the African-American community would be hit the hardest. Also, when you put on top of that, we know that a lot of the essential workers who work in these healthcare spaces, healthcare aides, security of people, people who work in dietary and environmental services, as well as the nursing and doctor in the medical area. But there's a high concentration of people from our communities that are employed at those other level of jobs. And so they would be coming into these environments where, you know, COVID was present and then going back into their communities. Sometimes using public transportation, sometimes catching a ride with their uncle and them, right? And so we know that there was a real potential. So we reached out to back in March to the county executive and the health commissioner and some other leaders in the healthcare field with leaders from our community, Dr. Vasquez and others. And we said to them, they said, listen, what's your plan? What's the, you know, we know this is coming. We laid out, you know, the possible vulnerabilities of our community. And at that moment, they really hadn't thought, began to think about those things in those terms. So what we said to them, said, listen, we're going to come back to you with a plan of how we're going to address this issue. And we need you to resource it. We need you to support it, right? Because these are our dollars as well. Right. And so after some going back and forth and what have you, we were able to use some of the Medicaid reimbursement monies through the DSRIP, the Millennium Collaborative Care, through Erie County, being able to stand up what we call the COVID-19 response team. And what we did, Skylar, is we put we got 15 churches on the east and west side. And we developed these COVID response call centers. And we got a list from the Board of Elections and other resources. And we had our targeted area. And we hired a lot of younger people who, a lot of them were home from college, you know, what have you. Got them an iPhone, got them a laptop, got them a list. Dr. Vasquez and his team through GVON had developed this tremendous IT system that allowed for our responders to actually make appointments for people right there from their call center or what have you. And so we literally called almost everybody in our community. And then if people But we still, what we learned too, there's still a percentage of people in our community that don't have a cell phone or a landline. So we engaged the National Witness Project, who are already doing some community engagement, community health work type stuff. And we said to them, knock on these doors for us because we can't reach these people. And so why were we reaching out to them? Well, we wanted to find out, one, you know, if they had any symptoms. Two, if they had any access to tests. Three, do they have a primary care physician? Four, do they have some food insecurities? Five, how are they doing mentally? So we asked these five questions pretty much, and these people were trained. And we were able to not only ask those questions, but to give some kind of response to attaching people to help. Right. So if you're having some of these symptoms or what have you, hey, you know, get to your primary care. Oh, you don't have a primary care? Well, through our network, we got GBOM, we got Jericho Road, we can plug you into a primary care physician. Oh, you need transportation? We'll come pick you up. You need food? We engage with Alex over at the African Heritage Food Co-op, who does a tremendous job. And we said to Alex, here's a chunk of money. Get what you need, and then let's set up a delivery system, right? And so when people needed food, we were able to get that to them. We work with Best Health if their people needed some mental health stuff, because people are dealing with a lot of stuff. Make that appointment for you. And then when we learned that there weren't enough testing sites within community, we were able to stand up the testing site at the Leroy Coles Library. We said to those who had access to testing, we need tests in our community health centers, because the people at the community health center, the people at Jericho Road, the people at GBOD, Dr. Lusu at Rafa Medicine, those sites, they're already dealing with people in our community prior to COVID, so they need to have access to the resources in order to get them some help. And so, you know, it wasn't easy, but we kind of put this plan together. So here's the good news. So when we started the project, March, April, and the first data started coming in. Now, nationally, African Americans are dying at about 2.5 to 3 times their population rate as it relates to COVID, right? Erie County, African Americans make up 14.6% of the population in Erie County. The early data was showing that about 33% of the fatalities were from the African American community, which was trending pretty much at the national level. But then as we did our work, made our calls, connected people to resources, gave people access to PPEs and others, and not only us, but there were other partners in the community. So what happened is we were able to stimulate and generate some energy that not only our project was having an impact, but it loosened other resources and other things within community where others were doing some really great work as well, right? And so as the data began to come back, we saw a trending downward to the point where in June, only 16.7% of the fatalities in Erie County were from the Black community. And to make it even better, the latest data we got just this week, even in the midst of the second wave and the trending upward, that only 14.7% of the deaths are from the Black community, which was right in alignment, statistically in alignment with the population. We're one of the few cities in America that can make that claim. Why is that? Black leadership with a vision. We're already working in community with these around these issues. Connecting with resources and systems and institutions that have an obligation to serve the Black community, right? If you're the county health department, well, the last I heard, the community was in Erie County, right? And so you make these systems do what they are designed to do, what their mission is. And then other healthcare providers and institutions, insurers and others, Collider and others, and say, listen, we need you to invest your resources and help us get this thing done. But also critically following the leadership of healthcare professionals that are already operating within those communities. Guys like Dr. Vasquez, guys like Dr. Glick, right? Women like Dr. Lusu and Dr. Ansari, right? Who are already there on the front lines. So they have to be resourced and equipped so that they can do what they need to do. And the results are undeniable. Data speaks for itself.
Yeah.
And so, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, compared to nationwide data, it's an anomaly. The work that you described is just, amazing. The coordination and just the scale of it to achieve that type of outcome compared to national statistics where, blacks make up a significant portion of the, a significant and disproportionate compared to their, population, a portion of the COVID-19 deaths. That's commendable.
And shout out to Rev. Kinzer Pointer, who's provided great leadership on this. And others within our team, Dr. Willie Underwood, Rita Robinson, Kelly Walford. We have just a wonderful team of people who have worked tirelessly on the issues of health equity. Right. And so, but what we can't do is because really what our vision with our Buffalo Center for Health Equity, the African American Health Equity Task Force, and then the university having its community research institute under CTSI, under Dr. Murphy, who, and this is another really great outcome, is that standing up that institute in the system, in embedded in the university, that its focus and its mission is to look at health disparities and to research, and then not only research, but to come up with remedies and engaging not only the medical school, but the other academic disciplines. School of Education, the School of Law, the School of Management, the School of Nursing, the School of Social Work. They're all partners with us in this work so that when we start coming up with solutions, then we're able to draw upon the expertise that operate within these schools to come up with innovative and creative responses to some of these issues that are creating these health inequities. So Dr. Tim Murphy has been fantastic, who is head of the CTSI, Dr. Margaret Grinsley, Dr. Henry Taylor, Dr. Heather Oram. They've all just been great partners with us in this work, to the point right now where we were able to get through the School of Nursing a grant from what they call a PCORI grant, where we're going to be actually looking at how the impact of mental health has on these communities post-COVID, right? And from what I understand, it's one of the first kind of community university kind of collaborations to look at issues that are specifically designed to provide information, but also support for issues in our community. So we're making some progress, and we're really excited about it.
I'm excited about it too. It's great to hear that there's been all this progress made at the community level, at in different types of institutional levels. You're dealing with Erie County Department of Public Health, and also too, getting UB on board, which is located within the community, so it might as well have a stake.
Be involved. Universities have a responsibility to do problem solving, and what's the point of doing all this research and having all this knowledge if you don't take the research and knowledge to better humanity? And so that message has been heard, and the university and the institution has been very responsive, and we're very hopeful in the future about the work we're going to do together.
That's great. So I have another question. What is the Concern Clergy Coalition of Western New York, and how do they relate to the the issues of equity that you
mentioned. Reverend Poynter and myself and a few others were kind of the ones right after the death of Eric Garner. And we organized clergy, about 90 clergy in the area, to begin to start having conversations about those issues and how they, what's happening here in Buffalo. And we began to start talking about, you know, thinking about how we can provide leadership around health, economic development, criminal justice, and something else I forgot. But, and so I've kind of, education. And so I kind of grabbed the health piece, and we've been working, ever since on those issues. The concerned clergy represents, there are about 5 or 6 different ministerium groups in the Black community. And so they all kind of came together under this banner of concerned clergy. And we're working on these kind of social justice type issues, doing our best to present a united front, even though we differ in some ways on issues theologically and doctrinally, but there's agreement that we must come together to work for the betterment of the conditions of our people. And so we've been functioning, you know, pretty well. It's difficult because, you know, historically, again, you know, there hasn't been this kinds of unity amongst Black clergy. but we're not as divided as people think, but we're not as unified as we should be. So we're a work in progress. But the concerned clergy has been functioning, and certainly, again, Reverend Poynter has been a leader in that group, and but we've been really spending a lot of our energies around health issues. Bishop Badger's been spending a lot of energy around education, and so we're trying to span out our influence in these spaces.
Okay. Yeah. Thanks for providing that background. I have another question. So has the Concerned Clergy Coalition of Western New York played any roles in, say, addressing the issues surrounding the pandemic?
Well, yeah. I mean, it's so I wear a lot of hats. So. When I'm operating in these spaces, the concerned clergy, I'm representing them. You know what I mean? So, and we report back, and we have conversations about things, and you know, I know I can always depend upon these guys and ladies for support. And so the efforts around the pandemic have really been channeled through our work through the Buffalo Center for Health Equity and the African American Health Equity Task Force, right? So the concerned clergy are part of that work, and so and then when other churches and other groups try to do things, we will support them and resource them, you know, and it sort of works that way. One of the things that though what we did this week was begin to start educating the community around the pending vaccine. And we had a conversation on, I believe it was Wednesday, with Dr. Alan Lessie, who is an epidemiologist at the university and really an expert on these issues of infectious disease. And so we, this issue with the vaccine, because of our history, we know that the data is showing only about 43-44% of Black people who have been polled so far have said that they would be willing to take the vaccine. And I understand those low numbers. There's a historical context. There's a rationale behind. Dr. Michael Eric Dyson would say that Black people are not skeptical of science. We're skeptical of scientists. And so we have to get over, no, I shouldn't say this. We have to enhance our understanding and knowledge around issues as it relates to research. We have to have more Black folks involved in research. We have to engage in participatory research, and we have to engage more with institutions that have access to data and have conversations so that we'll have operate with a greater knowledge base around this vaccine. So that's what we're trying to do. The fact is that the FDA and the CDC have put the, you know, Pfizer, Moderna, and all the companies that are developing the vaccine through a rigorous four-step process that would certainly maximize the probability that when the vaccine comes into the public, that it will be safe. And in fact, I believe one of the lead scientists in the development of the vaccine was an African-American woman. And forgive me that I don't have her, can't call her name right quick. And so when the vaccine emerges, we have to, the decisions that we make on whether or not we're going to take it have to be based on facts and knowledge. Right. And we need to hear from, I know that Morehouse is going to play a role in investigation and disseminating information into community about the vaccine. So we need to hear from Black doctors about this, you know, and it locally, you know, hearing for me from Dr. Vasquez and Dr. Underwood and people like that in community who I trust. And if they say, hey, this will be something that'll be beneficial to our people and to our community, I will follow that leadership. But we have to be very, this is a very delicate situation. And we cannot be dismissive of people when they express their reservation and concern about that, about the vaccine. And we should listen to their concerns and answer any and all questions with the hope that if the vaccine is going to be beneficial for our people, that everyone in our community does take it. But we also have to be involved in the process of distribution, right? And so, what good would the vaccine be if it's gone through all four phases of approval, but yet it's not available to people within our communities? So we have to continue to advocate and be at the table and say, okay, you know, we're high risk. We are already struggling with a lot of issues. We got a lot of our people who are working as frontline workers in these healthcare facilities. So we want to make sure that people within our community have the information about the vaccine and also access to the vaccine when distribution begins.
Yep, those are very important issues, and I imagine that the task force and the clergy coalition are going to play a big role in trying to have a plan for Buffalo's Black communities as far as equitable distribution, and also to like you said, an information campaign to build trust and address the roots of the historic roots of the mistrust towards scientists.
And one of the outcomes of our project is we've developed just piles of data now, right? I mean, we've we've made, you know, I think over 100,000 contacts with people. And so, each one of them is a data point. And so we're going to be able to, as one of the outcomes of our project, be able to really make some really strong programmatic and policy recommendations about how do we can better serve the African American community based on the data that we're collecting, and so we strongly believe that research will give you data. Data will inform policy, and then policy will bring resources. And so we have to make sure that we are very aggressive in those all four of those phases. And because really, what's happened, Skylar, over years is our people have been measured and surveyed and queried, and then institutions have gotten tremendous grant and funding opportunities to do that. But then once we compile the data, and identify these issues, there never seems to be a follow-up with policy recommendations to address those. So it's one thing to survey a people and find out y'all got a lot of diabetes. Then, this next step is now here are the programmatic things we're going to put in place to address those conditions. That has not happened at the level that we needed to happen. So that's one of the reasons why it's very important that we have this collaboration with the university and others around research. Research is critical. And we have to, one of my goals is to have research to no longer be a bad word in our community. Because and I understand. So I'm not yet right. But we understand though the importance of research and importance of research being done right and making sure we don't take the data from the research to weaponize our people, but take the data to be a bridge to getting resources to change the condition of our people. And that can only happen when Black leadership's involved. I mean, and that's, we got to be real about that. We need to insist that Black leadership is involved, and we have to make sure that Black leadership is Black leadership, meaning not just Black people in leadership is not Black leadership. There's a difference between there, right? Right. And so we have to have Black folks who are in positions of influence and leadership to be unapologetic advocates for the conditions of their people, right? And not get tied up in the semantics of whether you should say defund the police or not. That's the absolutely wrong conversation to have. And it's an unhelpful critique for people in leadership to critique that phrase without looking at, but without putting your energy around the issues of why people are saying that. Right. And so we have to understand the nuances of how can you be an advocate for Black people? The only way you can do that is to listen to Black people, right? And to share their concerns in an unfiltered, unabridged way, so that we can really begin to start getting at the root. You know, and there's a generation, your generation. I have four sons and one daughter, and your generation is very clear of the directness, you know. And so I'm grateful to see the kind of the shiftings, like, you know, the unwillingness to play semantical games and to appease white institutions, but to say, listen, you know, we have a right to be in this space, and we have a right to advocate for our people, and we have a right to use the knowledge bases and the things that we've learned from these institutions to better the condition of our own people. And that is a critical, critical piece that I think we have to see in terms of shifting in our approach in our community.
Very, very well put. And that actually leads to I have a final question. Is there anything else that you'd like to share with our listeners? Any kind of you said a lot and but putting you on the spot. But anything else before we conclude our interview with you?
I guess a message. I mean, I'm sure a lot of students listen to this. The issue around race. I think this is our season to really engage in real meaningful conversations about, and I like to say, put it this way, to take the power of racism or to diminish the power of racism in our culture. While as a theologian, I would be hopeful that we could eliminate racism, but also as a sociologist, because I have a degree in sociology, well, understanding that I think our best hope is to be able to diminish the power of racism and the power of white supremacy and the ideology of white supremacy and its influence on institutions, to diminish that power that it has, I think is something that we could, which is a realistic goal. And I think it happens through, people engaging in transparent and honest conversations about the history and the present practice of white supremacy and systemic racism, and to engage in conversations that would define allyship in the terms that centers the needs of Black people in that allyship work. And to be cautious in our conversations about intersectionality to the point where I believe that we do that, but not at the expense of the needs of Black people. And I think what has happened historically post six, I know we're going to run out of time, but post civil rights, I think that at times our desire to do intersectional work and to do coalition work has at times put the needs of Black people secondary, right? And so we have to be smart, cautious, learn from our past practices, and then to be innovative. I mean, to recognize that there has to be new approaches to things. I think folks of my generation have to make spaces for sunsetting some activities and organizations that may have been effective for a season, but there's a new opportunity here, and I think we need to make room and spaces for the next level of leadership. But I also will caution the next level of leadership to not discount the wisdom of the elders, right? And so one of the things that diminishes our strength is when we have conversations of like pushing the old folks, old guard out the way. And, this is our time, right? And I think we, by doing such, you diminish the opportunity to glean wisdom from folks that have been on the battlefield and can maybe give some wise counsel on how to deal, because the enemy is wise and the enemy does not separate generationally. The enemy passes down the wisdom of how to maintain power and control down to the next generation. And that's why there's been so much success to keep this generational dominance. And so so those are the things, that's the final things kind of what I would like to share with folks. And then just inviting people to engage, log on to our website, buffalohealthequity.org. And then when you see activities and things going on around campus, around community, around health equity, around justice, get engaged. Don't wait for somebody else to do this. This is your season, your responsibility. And if you're a person of good conscience, and there's so much happening right now, it's a great opportunity for you to get engaged and to begin to shape the society in the way in which we want to be. And it's only going to happen if we get engaged.
Thank you for those thoughtful parting remarks. And thanks again for taking the time to be interviewed on our podcast. We hope to have you on again to discuss future projects. You know, for example, when once the vaccine becomes available, how things are going to go with the task force and the coalition with helping out with distribution and the information campaigns. We definitely want to follow up on that. And I had a question. Is there a way for our listeners can learn more about the task force
Buffalo
and the coalition?
BuffaloHealthEquity.org. BuffaloHealthEquity.org. With all the information. And if you want to send us any questions or anything like that, we have a way to respond.
And for our listeners, are there any volunteer opportunities?
I think so. I'm not sure right now. You know what I mean? Again, BuffaloHealthEquity.org. I know that we have some students doing some academic stuff, I think one thing too is checking with people like Dr. Heather Oram, Dr. Grinsley, Dr. Taylor, and Dr. Murphy, and Dr. Lessie, if any of them are your professors, and Heather Abraham over at the law school. Reach out to them and say, hey, is there some things that I can do in terms of supporting your connection to the task force? And we're always open. We're looking for, ideas. We want to be a place to support and convene new ideas. So, there may be some things that I had a conversation with a young lady that wanted to do some internship work. And I said to her, I said, that's great. So, and she said, well, what do you want me to do? I said, now I want you to tell me what you want to do. You come up, I'm interested in your creative minds. We don't need anybody just come run copies for us. Right. I want to mine the intellect of young people. And mind their ideas. Do you know what I mean? As opposed to just giving them some tasks, right? Because I think that's where the power is. And so so I would just encourage people, we would welcome ideas and thoughts and let's see what we come up with.
Okay. And again, listeners, that is BuffaloHealthEquity.org, correct?
BuffaloHealthEquity.org. And also we got another website of a project we're working on called Pride in Place Buffalo. Pride in Place Buffalo. And it's a collaboration with LISC and AARP where we're actually going to be doing some creative things. So just about celebrating and loving our folks in our communities. It's going to be real artsy and just really trying to lift, we've been dealing with this trauma, right? And we got to learn how to celebrate ourselves, celebrate what's happening in our community that's good. Celebrate the artists, the people, we're working with folks with like from the Wakanda Alliance and there's some folks that are just doing some great things on the ground, man. And we need to support them and we need to resource them. And so you can, and if you go to BuffaloHealthEquity.org, there, I think there's a link to, but if there's other ones called Pride in Place Buffalo. And you'll see some exciting things. And there'll be some things. We're looking for artists. We're looking for all kinds of folks in that. So that would be a place to kind of link into something.
Okay. Yeah, thank you very much. And again, I'm Skylar Lawson. And thank you all for listening to another episode of Buffalo Healthcast. Take care and be well. This has been another episode of Buffalo Healthcast. Tune in next time to hear more about health equity in Buffalo, the U.S., and around the globe.